Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain, Bradley Burrows, and guests.
This is the NZ Tech Podcast, episode 42.
Yes, Paul's age.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You guys might be that old, but I'm certainly not just yet.
No, mate, you don't look a day over 45.
No.
Man, that's harsh. That's harsh. I'll tell you, talking of birthdays, my son was one yesterday.
Oh, congrats, awesome. Little buddy.
Yep. So, Pablo, if you're listening, son, happy birthday a day late.
He's just sucking the iPhone at the moment because it vibrates.
you brought him the new 4S for his birthday, I trust.
He's talking to it going, Dada, and it's going, I love you, says Siri.
That's right. Right, so this evening we've got a few topics, as always, chatting a little bit about security. Apple breaks through a barrier in market share. We're talking a little bit about local computer news provider, Computer World, who have hit a milestone themselves. We're chatting about the iDev event. Brad, what you had some discussion around Steve Jobs' book.
Yeah, I'm reading it at the moment. And there's some good little quotes in there that I just thought would be interesting to discuss. And okay. I know we've all consumed some of it. So
yep, okay, all right. We'll dive into that. We'll chat a little bit about iCloud apps and a couple of other topics. So yeah, let's jump into all those things. Number one, Apple. What's yes. going on? They've hit like this milestone that apparently Steve Jobs spoke about 10 years ago that they were going to break through. They were aiming to reach 5% market share.
Yep.
In the PC, well, you know, personal computer business.
Yep.
And they've done it. They've hit 5.2. It's been announced by IDC.
Yep, their highest market share in 15 years. So just so we're clear, if they're listening, we believe that this includes iPads and all their PCs, MacBook Airs, all those type of devices, but does not include their smartphone market share.
I don't think it includes the tablets either from what I'm reading, but that...
Yeah. We're debating that one heavily in the background here. But for the moment, we'll go off the IDC stuff. So that's what they're saying at the moment, but it's good. I think, and I mean, a lot of people are sort of going, they're only 5.2% market share. That people, everyone's like, they should be 40 or 50 because they have so much of everyone's hearts and minds with all their devices at the moment, and yet their global market share is quite tiny. But I think it's a good
tiny.
Thing.
They're definitely one of the big players. You know, it's not as though anyone's got a huge percent. No one's got like 20% or something like that, right?
I think the thing they do really well is they market to the place they want to be.
Yes.
So they tend to look like they're punching well above the weight that they actually are.
Yeah, and I think I can't remember the Windows numbers. I think Windows is around the 80% mark, and I think it's these guys have got the other 5, and then there's a whole lot of Linux and different distros that sort of make up the remainder. But I think it's a good thing. I think the higher the market share we get out there, it means that we're going to have, it's going to make the Apple products a lot more robust than they are. It's going to make them, they're going to get hacked, they're going to find viruses, they're going to be all that stuff, that ecosystem that the Windows world's had to go through, and it's going to make the product that spits out the end a much better product for all of us. So I think it's a good milestone. I just hope it doesn't take them 15 more years to get the 10%. I think they'll do that a lot quicker.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, 5% may not sound like a huge amount in terms of total market share, but when you look at that from a revenue perspective, I think it's very different, because what you've got to remember with Apple is, you know, traditionally their machines are priced, you know, somewhere between 10 and say 50% more than a comparable machine of any other specification.
Yep.
So, or of a similar specification, but you know, if it's carrying the Apple logo, you are paying that price premium. So it probably doesn't cost them much more to actually manufacture their machines than anyone else. So at that point, it means, you know, if we think of, say, let's say it's a 5% margin that HP makes on each machine, if Apple are manufacturing a machine for the same price but selling it for, let's say, 50% more, then Apple potentially could be making 10 times as much profit per machine as HP. And I think that's what we're seeing with Apple's profits out there that have been in the, you know, huge billions of dollars, is that they're making big margin on every single product that they sell. in general. So they don't necessarily need to have a huge market share in every space, although obviously they've had a good market share in mobile and tablet spaces. But, you know, as long as they're able to charge that premium price that the Apple brand, you know, allows them to do that, then, hey, they're laughing, shareholders are happy, right?
I think the big thing, though, is that also is that they're growing faster than any other products out there. So that's the PCs, the Linux, and everything else. And that's a key thing. It's whatever you're doing, as long as you're outgrowing the competition, even if you're a small percentage, it means you're going to chew away really, really quickly. So, yeah, it's good. I think it's great for Apple.
Yep, great for the shareholders anyway. That's capitalism in action. Right, Computer World.
Yes, they're 25. Congratulations, guys.
Computer World New Zealand, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. So when did you guys first see a copy of Computer World?
Well, I've been in the industry 20-something years. I probably saw it about 18 years ago. Once I got into it, I started. I remember getting the old paper editions of it, and then moving around. I think it's good. I've been lucky. I've written a few articles for Computer World, and yeah, it's a good publication. I think it's great. We need to celebrate. These guys have been around for a quarter of a century.
It's impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, New Zealand market, and they've got some great publications there. It's a good online benchmark of what's going out in the IT industry. So I hope they have another 25 years. They've been a good sounding board for the industry.
Skip, yeah.
What about you, mate? Have you been?
Yeah. I was just having a think about when was the first time I saw it. It's probably, I'd hate to think how long ago. But one thing I really noticed about it was it used to be the place where you'd go and find your IT jobs. Because they listed that heavily in the back of, it's almost half the publication at some stage. And it gave a real indication of where the industry was at. You know, if half the magazine was adverts, the industry was doing some really good stuff. It was really going well.
Bingo.
And I remember when I started seeing the jobs starting to drop off, that's when you started getting the indicator of the industry. It's starting just to grind down a little bit. So I think it's been great as a tool to be able to see where the New Zealand space has been for IT. And to actually hear stories of some of the great local innovations that have been going on as well.
Yeah, I remember reading it. I was when I was at school, actually. That was quite some time ago, late 80s. And it would always be an interesting read. But there were always terms and things in there that I didn't understand. I hadn't been exposed to the technology, and of course there was no NZ Tech podcast to listen to back in the 80s. So that was one of the few sources of local information to actually keep up to date with what was happening here in New Zealand on a regular basis.
I think you've picked a really interesting point that it talked about stuff in the language, the industry language. And for someone getting into the industry, it was actually a good tool to get your head around various aspects of computer industry, the computer, the changing face of the IT industry. So for me, I was the same as you. I looked at it at some stages and went, I have no idea what that is, but I'm going to go and find out. And it was a great learning tool as well. So, and I think when you're in school, the internet wasn't in New Zealand yet, so there was no podcasts.
Yeah. Well, the internet existed, but not for the general consumer and general public. So universities had internet-based email and so on. So, I mean, looking now on the map, obviously Computer World's still here. That's great. That is still targeted more at the tech industry. And, of course, our listeners are a whole mix of people that are involved in the industry, people that are enthusiastic about technology, or people that are just using various, you know, gadgets and want to learn a little bit more. What are the other publications you guys would pick out that are, that are well worth looking at? Or would you say that online is really the place where you get your info? I mean, it is nice to pick up some of the glossies and the magazines to have sort of something on your coffee table or to read when you're not in front of an iPad or a laptop or something. But it has moved more to an online context, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I get given PC World to read. I read The Reseller, The Channel. I read Computer World. These are the publications I get in my hands. But I actually go online and read most of those. And I read all the... I have a passion for reading the UK versions of a lot of those publications, like the PC World and all sorts of stuff. I like the UK flavour that they get. A lot of the articles that are over in New Zealand, actually, they subscribe and pull it in from the US or the UK. So they seem to be a bit more cleaner from those ones. But Computer World is definitely one that I do still like to get. In fact, I've got one in my bag now that I will read and actually go through and see what's going on in the industry and look at the articles.
Yeah, and it's the same for me. I'm mostly online, and I guess if I was to subscribe heavily to a publication on paper, it's going to be Computer World itself. So, but other than that, it's generally all online now.
Okay, that's good. Good to hear that feedback. Now, Brad, you wanted to chat about bind security updates.
Yes.
Now, this may sound like gobbledygook to some of our listeners. What does all that mean?
Well, gobbledygook or bind? Sorry, bind. So for the people listening out there, the way the internet works when you type in a friendly domain like www.nztechpodcast.co.nz, that goes to a DNS server or a lookup server, domain name service, and it looks up the name to the IP address. Now, most of that in the world runs on a Linux software called bind. That's the DNS server. Now, every now and then, this thing's normally rock solid. I mean, it is rock solid. But every now and then when they have a small issue, it isn't quite a small issue because it affects X number of percentage of the world's internet services. And Bind's just announced that they've actually got a bit of a security flaw, and it's actually one that where they've said immediately update. Now, the Linux security guys don't normally say immediately update unless there's a little bit of a hole there. So if you are a sysadmin out there and you are running any of the Linux bind in your organization, I strongly recommend you go and find out from your provider who gave you the Linux to actually go out there and do it. If you do want to know more, there's a fantastic article on the register.co.uk which actually goes through and actually shows you what the exploit is, and there are exploits in market. Skip.
Yeah, I was going to say the DNS stuff is a little bit of a sacred cow in terms of the internet, and to leverage into that space is can be quite a dramatic problem. So remember a while back there was that security issue around certificates where crowds like, I'm trying to think of their name, there was a crowd in Denmark handing out certificates.
Netherlands,
yeah. They were handing out certificates that were basically... they were like Google certificates or Microsoft certificates,
yep.
Signed as Microsoft and Google, and for all intents and purposes for those users at home, seemed to be absolutely fine. Now, just imagine if you take that, create a site for Microsoft.com, and then leverage off the DNS. Then you start getting yourself into a really interesting sequence.
Or for a bank.
Banks.
Right, log into a bank and it looks as though it's all correct and away you go.
Yeah, and it can suck you in. So you want to be very... I mean, I've just had a quick peruse to the latest update and they said, while this is serious, the sky's not falling, just make sure you do this in a timely manner, which is kind of an interesting way of looking at it from a security perspective.
It is definitely sysadmins, go, patch now. Stop listening. Go and patch the servers now.
We'll be on air for another 30 minutes. Keep going.
Fortunately, that's not most of us, so we can leave that to those in the back room that look after those things. But the interesting thing here is that we're seeing a lot more issues, even just throughout this year. We're seeing more and more security-related issues that impact all sorts of systems, from the normal sorts of computers to, you know, obviously earlier on the year, you know, Sony got really hit really hard with their systems being specifically targeted. There's been a whole range of things this year. The one I found interesting this year, in the last week, was the water plants in the US that had been hacked. Did you guys read about that at all?
Yeah, I did read the article, but hold on. Didn't Skip hack a water plant when he was down at KiwiCon? I'm sure, in last week's episode, didn't he say that they hacked a water plant? Can you not remember that conversation we had with him?
It was a power and research company, I believe.
Oh, okay.
But what they did down there is they actually highlighted exactly the same scenario as what's happened there in the state. A lot of the underlying infrastructure that sits and controls industrial controls is a system called SCADA. And it's probably easy to say that it's in its infancy in terms of security. So the idea is it's secure because you've got a great big fence up around it and no one can get in and get to it. But once someone gets into it, it's all on for young and old. Now, remember the Stuxnet worm that came out? That hit the globe and everyone was all worried about this phrase Stuxnet. That was a virus that was specifically written to target SCADA systems in what they believe was Iran's nuclear facilities.
So what does SCADA stand for again?
That's cruel.
Hold on, I'll look it up. Here we go. supervisory control and data acquisition. That still sounds like gobbledygook to me.
Yeah, okay. So what SCADA is it's basically the instruction language that industrial controllers use to talk to each other and to talk to devices to make things happen. I know, I've just put you off to sleep. But just think about it this way.
So when you're talking about a water plant, they need to be able to control the flow of water, all that sort of stuff. It's the technology that makes all that happen.
Yep. Now,
is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yep. It doesn't just control what happens, like turn things on, turn things off. It also prevents things from going overboard. So in this case, they basically just wound a pump to destruction, just wound it way past its maximum tolerances, and it just blew up. Because industrial controls are designed to be pushed as hard as they can, even to the point of destruction, and it's up to the engineers to write code to keep that safe.
Sure.
So that's what they did overseas. They basically injected into some SCADA system and just told it to wind the pump to destruction.
So this is what had just happened in Houston, Texas.
Yeah. So this is a form of attack we're going to see a lot more of. Hacker groups and hacker conferences are talking a lot more about SCADA. And I think companies that specialize in SCADA, like the Omron control type companies, are working a lot harder to try and keep their stuff secure now.
Well, who says then we're not going to have our power cut off in New Zealand? We're not going to have, I mean, all sorts of issues. Well, not just here, anywhere.
Well, that's exactly it.
So potentially anywhere is at risk.
And that's what's concerned everyone about the Stuxnet virus, is that when they did a bit of a post-analysis on it, they found it on a raft of devices across the globe. So this thing had actually gone and spread itself, and it was lucky in the sense that it was only specifically targeting a specific space, which was the Iranian nuclear facilities. Otherwise, it could have wreaked quite a bit of havoc. So it is something that you've got to be concerned with. I wouldn't put it past the security people at these companies that they're actually really working hard to keep things secure and working hard to just tighten stuff up a bit. So, yeah, it's an interesting story, but I'd say we're going to see a lot more of that in the next couple of years.
Okay. No, that's interesting. Now, a quick little mini update on Ice Cream Sandwich, which is a new version 4 of the Android operating system. We see a lot of smartphones and tablets today. It seems that we're going to see updates for a really broad number of devices coming through next year. So the first one out, what have we got? Is it the Nexus Galaxy, I think, is one of the first to... Galaxy Nexus is one of the first ones to come out. There are going to be a whole range, and from what we're hearing, a large chunk, at least of the higher end Android phones and devices shipped this year, will be able to get the new version.
So, what is Ice Cream Sandwich? For the people out there listening that don't really know what Ice Cream Sandwich is, what does it mean, Paul? If I was to go out and say, oh, I've just bought an Ice Cream Sandwich Android device, what do I get?
So I guess it's just the next iteration of the Android software. So smartphones, in theory, will be a little bit smarter when they're running Android 4. I mean, we've talked about it before. It's sort of the coming together of the version 2.3 of Android and the version 3. So you had separate version there for the smartphone and for the tablet. It brings that together into one version that can run on both tablets and phones. It's still, you know, in its infancy as a new version, but you know we'll see, you know, a lot more activity in that space over the next little while, and it'll start, you know, becoming available for people's existing devices.
So. It's also got a new UI for the touch-based devices, hasn't it? That's one of the other big things I was reading about it with, which I'm looking forward to seeing, is that I think the merging of the codes is good, but I think the new touch-based interface is really going to be one of the big leaps for Android 3 devices.
I reckon it brings it up in par with the likes of iPhone and Windows Phone 7 in terms of UI experiences.
Well, that's a big call.
I reckon so. I mean, there's a lot of nice little UI features that just makes life a bit easier for the Android user.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an improvement on the user, from that user interface perspective. But I don't think we're necessarily going to, we're going to see it become as consistent as some of the other operating systems. Because everyone still wants to put their own sort of paintbrush or their own, flavor of it out, which is one of the issues with Android, is all these different sort of variations. Now, I think we mentioned this last week, but just mentioning it again, the NZ iDev conference, which is a about Barcamp style event for people that want to develop apps for iPhone, iPad, etc. So that's happening this coming weekend. So worth looking that up if you're interested in joining in.
Whereabouts is it again, Paul?
It's happening here in Auckland. I can't recall off the top of my head the venue, but if you do a quick Google or Bing search, you will you'll find all the details.
Cool. I think it's good to get along to these things as well. Even if you're not a iOS developer, you're on another platform, I think it's great to see, because you got to remember now, if you're developing an app, it's got a reality now is it's got to work across multiple platforms, because each app ecosystem, so whether it's Windows Phone, iPhone, Android Marketplace, is getting big now, isn't it? So,
absolutely, and I think that was one of the things last year. There, you know, a number of the guys that went along were Microsoft type developers who were just expanding their horizons and so on. And I think, it makes sense to do it. So definitely get along if that's you. And it was very, very well priced. I think it's something like $100. Basically, it's just to cover the costs. So yeah, well worth it. Now, Brad, you had some comments from your further reading or listening to Steve Jobs' book. What was that sort of? What was your let's call it your quote of the week from Steve Jobs?
So, people listening, this book is fantastic, and I think it's a must read for the Christmas holidays. It's a quite an intense read. It's about 900 pages, and I'm reading it as an ebook. So, but he is a very interesting man, and I've learned a lot about him, and a lot of stuff has been confirmed. But one of the great things he was talking about when he was sort of looking back on things, and it was I've just up to the part where him and Woz have been inventing some stuff for Atari. He said, looking at what Apple did in their first few years and in later on and when he came back in 96, Paul? 96 when he came back? That he said...
I'm not even going to get into that discussion after our last debate. Again.
But look, he said, look, Apple didn't invent things. Apple reinvented what failed or what other people didn't do well. And he said, he talked then about, how Xerox really had this massively clunky mouse, which is this huge box. And he said, we reinvented that and made the sleek system. An iPod-style device had been around before, but they made it sexy. Apple took things that couldn't be marketed correctly and redid it, made it polished, made it look beautiful, and made us want to buy it because the aesthetics of it are amazing, And I really thought that sums up, what Apple was all about with Jobs. He took things and went, I can do that better. And you see that when he's a kid as well. He basically would look at things and going, I can do that smarter. He would challenge people around him, and he would say to Woz, right, Woz, normal IBM are building a PC with 50 computer chips. I want you to do it with 25 chips, for instance. Mm. And Woz would challenge himself on how to do it and come back and say, hey, Steve, I've done it. Okay, let's do it with 20. Mm. And he'd do that. And so it's really interesting. And they would just reinvent. And they just they didn't take other people's ideas, is not what I'm trying to say. They took what other people did, learned, and then made it better. And I think, but that's the computer industry, but it's really interesting hearing
that
from him.
Yeah, I think it's the way any industry or community works, isn't it? Everyone gets inspired by each other and,
totally.
And steps up. And, but one of Apple's differentiators is that they've, they really have managed to come up with products that are really attractive to the eye.
Bingo.
And, in a lot of cases have done something they've reinvented something. So they might not have invented it originally, but they've reinvented it and come up with it in a different way.
Yeah, they didn't invent a smartphone, but they reinvented it because they made it work. They made it consumerized, that it was easy to use. And that is Apple to a T. I mean, there's a very, very clever looking at products and going, oh, we can do that so much better.
I'd like to highly recommend, I've finished this book. I finished the audio book, which is actually 24 hours long worth of listening, and it is unbelievably fascinating.
Yeah,
it is a very good, especially if you've got time off over Christmas, get a copy, read it, listen to it. It is well worth the effort.
Yeah, and even if you're not a fan of technology, as in a real hardcore Apple fanboy, it's not designed. It's just designed as a.
It's learning, still a learning, good read for anyone, though.
It's
right,
learning about the man, who he was, and it was really interesting. He had some issues, but my goodness, he was smart. Oh boy.
Now, in other news, Microsoft should be pleased that their Windows Phone marketplace has reached or has passed 40,000 apps in the last week. That's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's grown quite quickly. I mean, we're talking about this just off air, and I think you get to a point where Apple and Android are where it just, once you break 50,000 apps or 100,000, it just becomes this giant snowball that just suddenly, it just compound growth, right? And they're going to get there soon. And I think 40,000 apps within, would you say 14 months? Would that be fair? Is that how long it's been? 14, 15 months? Or is it a bit longer than that?
At the most, yeah.
Yeah. So that's not bad.
No, in fact, it'd only be 13 months, I think. Did so it? it was October.
Yeah, it was October.
Last year, so... Yeah.
13 months.
Yeah, so we're talking 30 months. That's pretty quick. Yeah, I think you get to that point where it doesn't matter whether there's 100,000 apps or a million apps. All of the key ones are there, really, and it's now... you get to a point where when you reach that, say, 100,000 apps, and we're not there yet, but we will get to that point where all of those key things are sort of done and there isn't a lot of differentiation across the platform.
Skip. Now, what's missing from the marketplace right at the moment?
Just the thing I keep reminding you of every waking minute of every day is, where's Skype? The company that owns Skype now has not released Skype for its own devices. And I think, yes, you're right about the marketplace growing. It's quite phenomenal. But I think there's quite a lot of copy and paste code going on there as well. Now, it probably happened a lot in the Apple Store as well. But there's a lot of apps in there that you just wouldn't give the time of day to.
And
there's
a lot of apps that are just repetitive. That's a reflection of the number that's in there, right?
Yeah.
But there must be a point we will get to where we're very much the bulk of apps that have been successful on the top apps off every other platform are pretty much there. Now, we're not quite at that point yet, but we're very, very close to it. Skype would be one of the biggest ones that's really missing now.
Audible books for me is the one I'm waiting for, because yes. I like my audiobooks, and it's great on my other devices, but I would like that on my Windows Phone.
Do you think that's going to come out, or because it's from Audible's owned by Amazon, they're out trying to push their own devices now. Are they going to hold off a little bit?
No,
I've heard it's coming.
They'd be stupid to limit it to their own devices, because the market is not just their own devices. And if they can develop an app that actually pushes their product into different spaces, then why wouldn't you? I mean, they've already got the Amazon Kindle app for the Windows Phone 7, which works perfectly
fine.
That's true.
There's a lot of Amazon apps there already, or the key ones, the Marketplace and Kindle. So
yeah, it's going to be interesting. And I think part of the there's a bit of a sea change at the moment, especially with the discussion around Flash moving off mobile devices, that people are actually starting to write apps more for the mobile phones from a web perspective rather than an actual app perspective, because quite frankly you can still achieve the same amount of stuff in a web-based version of your app without having to go through a marketplace. So I mean, Google, for example, is developing a lot more of their stuff from a web-based platform rather than creating specific apps.
That's true. And in fact, I think it's Google that have announced that they're stopping some of their previous apps. Is it the Gmail app that they've pulled from BlackBerry?
Yes, that's right. Yep.
And so we're seeing a little bit of that as well. I mean, obviously at the moment there's still lots and lots of apps coming out and being promoted, but there's also a few web things coming through as well.
We'll just take a quick break while Paul eats his chocolate bar.
Crinkle crunchle, crinkle crunchle. Time check on that one there.
Yeah, I got it.
Get rid of that one. I'm going to throw in a few Easter eggs tonight too.
Yeah, I mean, the apps thing is, it's kind of cool seeing a store develop so quickly, but I often go back into the marketplace as much as possible and see what's new, and I'm just, there's nothing that blows my mind away at the moment. Well, I mean, the latest app that came through was Tango, which is that VoIP app which ties your device in. That was quite cool, but it still doesn't quite... I'm still waiting for those killer apps that I really want, like Skype, so...
I think the problem you're going to have, though, is whatever app you have, once you get Skype, there'll be another killer app, and then there'll be something else. I mean, and it'll be across all platforms. I mean, I look at... When I go to my other devices and have a play, I think, oh, I wish I had that app. And they're all going to come because, like I said, I mean, people that go to that iOS developer conference, I'm hoping that they're looking at thinking, well, if I create this for that, I'm going to go for the Google, the whatever other platform, the Windows Phone 7 platform. So yeah, they're all going to come. It's just it's, for some reason the Skype one's taking ages because they have demoed it, didn't they? Didn't they demo it in Las Vegas last year or was it early this year that where they showed us it? And I was like, yes, cannot wait. So
now another app that's been out there is Spotify. What do you guys know about Spotify?
I know a little bit, quite a bit. I've been talking about it a bit.
Well, that's right.
So Spotify is all about music, isn't it? It's about unlimited streaming music and being able to get access to a huge catalogue of music.
Yeah,
but so, it hasn't been available in New Zealand to date.
It creates your own playlist or radio stations, very similar to what Pandora is in the US. You can now subscribe per month or per year. There's 15 million songs in the database. It's a cloud-based service, which also allows you to download locally, but it holds all your playlists. So, if, for instance, I like Pearl Jam Nirvana music, it'll grab all that. It'll allow me to create playlists around those songs, but it'll also have smarts around it saying, well, hold on, if you like that, you might like Alice in Chains and something else. And it actually has a bit of smart DJ built into it, and it keeps everything up in the cloud, and it allows me, whatever device I'm using, it pulls down those playlists to that device. So, if I'm on a Windows phone or an Android or my PC or on, I do believe there is an app for the Apple TV. I need to confirm that, but I'm pretty sure there is.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Maybe the one I've got is a different version than other people might have out there at the moment, the one I'm playing with. So basically it allows you to pull those down and actually have that from that side. But everything's stored in the cloud, so it doesn't matter where you go. And it's a rival to iTunes. Be very, very clear about this. This is an iTunes compete. It is a Google Music compete. But it's very, very popular. Yes, skip in the corner.
What's this? Oh, I've got to say, I've just jumped in rudely. What's this Google Music you're talking about? I don't think we've discussed that on this podcast before.
Exactly. And the reason why we don't talk about it on this podcast is because it's only available in the States.
Correct.
But it just launched last week in the States, didn't it?
It's been in beta for a long time.
Yeah, but it's just officially launched and they've now got a bit of a catalogue.
Yeah. No, the thing is that you've got a lot of these online music services, but not many of them seem to have the ability to be able to negotiate a contract outside of the continental United States. So it's a bit of an odd one, really. It's great to see Spotify coming down to New Zealand. It's great to see companies like Spotify realizing there's more to the world than just the United States.
Well, there's another company you will have come across, small one based in Seattle in the US, Microsoft.
Are they still around?
Yeah. And they just launched in Australia last week a thing called the Zoom Pass.
Yep.
And Zoom Music. Not here in New Zealand, unfortunately, but the fact that they've launched in the Australian market, and I don't know whether Brad's heard any secrets about this stuff, and if he had, he probably couldn't tell us, or he'd have to shoot us, including our whole audience. So we're probably unlikely to hear any secrets on that. But the fact that they've now extended Zoom from originally in the US into Canada, UK, Australia, and some other markets now, is, I think, a good sign. They're working hard to sort of take that global. So that would be a good thing.
So there's only one company in the world that has mastered this, and that is Apple. Apple went out there, and they went to all the music labels around the world, and they negotiated all the legal contracts that you need to do, and they just went out there and with a blanket approach. And so basically, I think that's the...
It even took them some time, though, to get to Australia and New Zealand. It took quite a lot of time.
But they were the masters of it. So I think the biggest hurdle around the world about us having global music and having the same services is not the companies themselves, whether it's Google, Microsoft, whatever. It's actually the legal loopholes you have to jump through in each country to get through the copyright laws and everything else. Now, Apple have done it, and they were pretty... They were boyish and they got it through. I think that's the biggest hurdle that other companies face. And I mean, I don't know about the Microsoft New Zealand stuff, but from just looking at what I've read and heard about, I think that's the big one we've got to get through.
Hey, look, just to jump back to a previous topic, the Steve Jobs book does go through that in depth about how they did that, and it is unbelievably fascinating from that perspective. So it's definitely worth reading for that. And there actually was a lot of personal hard work with Steve actually approaching individual artists to try and get it done. I mean, that's just the level they went to. What Apple did with iTunes, I think they certainly opened the door for the rest of the marketplace, because there was a lot of resistance to actually put music online. So I think we owe Apple a huge gratitude of thanks for them to do that, because they really did break into that market for us.
Yeah. No, so the story on Spotify is early 2012, isn't it? That's what we're hearing when it comes to New Zealand. So that'll be cool. And for those who are stuck listening or visit our website, there are some techniques. If you do want to subscribe to some of the US-based services, there are ways to actually give you sort of legal access to those, a few hoops to jump through, but can be well worth it. Right, now, Brad, you wanted to have a little bit of a discussion around social networks. Now, most of us have got some sort of presence, whether it's on Facebook or LinkedIn, you know, Twitter, etc. Who actually owns that information? What are the risks for, say, for individuals or for businesses with putting that up there?
Before I answer that, let me just put a scenario to you guys. I work for company XYZ. We're doing really, really well at the moment. We're making millions of dollars, and I decide to create a Twitter, LinkedIn, and social media presence for us. I create it. Of course, I'll register it all under my name because I'm the social media person in that organization. And suddenly we go gangbusters, and our social media is doing really, really well. Now, I decide to move on from that company. Everything's registered under my name. The company, XYZ, doesn't actually own those Twitter handles. Doesn't actually own any of the stuff that I've created. I can take that with me because I don't own it, but I'm the registered manager of those particular services. And this was one of the things I was thinking about and I heard the other day was, who actually owns the Twitter handle? Well, Twitter owns the physical handle itself, but the person that registers it actually takes it with it. So if you've got an organization, and Paul, you run your own business, if for some reason one of your people in your team had created Gorilla, your business, created the Twitter presence, and they left, and they could actually take that with them, you would actually have to negotiate with them to get it back, which I find kind of interesting because we all just take it for granted.
I disagree with that from a legal standpoint. I think if you're working within a business and you do something on behalf of that business, then that is businesses. If you go and invent something when you're working for that business, usually part of your employment agreement says, you know, look, when you do XYZ, that's the business's property. The problem, I guess, is businesses who don't have employment agreements that are designed for modern types of things and don't consider things like software inventions, intellectual property that gets invented under the business, social media, those sorts of things. There is the potential to get into some issues, absolutely.
So I thought you might say that. So I spoke to a lawyer, and you're wrong. The actual person can take it with it because it's not covered under New Zealand law at the moment. In fact, it's not covered. It's only covered in one country at the moment, which is Norway. And at the moment, that part of the law is not covered under intellectual property. They started then getting into real technical areas around, well, this particular thing, if you've done it and registered it as a registered company, as a domain names are different. But Twitter handles and those aren't covered at the moment, which I found really interesting because I would have agreed with you if I hadn't spoke to this person. I would have thought, hey, if I invent something, surely that's taken it. But no, apparently not. Apparently legally, it's not at the moment.
Well, no, but legally will vary according to the situation. So if your employment agreement says that covers that, then those are covered. But because no one's probably got it in their employment agreements, then it's not going to.
You've got to be able to enforce something, though. That's the big problem. It's like a prenuptial agreement. You can't actually enforce a lot of them. So I understand exactly what you're saying.
I think there's also an ethical dilemma, right?
Oh,
you know,
totally.
Let's imagine you worked for, I'll pick a big organization, ASB, or any bank, right? And or any big organization, they might build up tens of thousands of followers.
Oh, yeah.
One social media presence might be worth to the business, might be worth, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, you know, if you walked away with that, you get into all sorts of ethical dramas, I'm sure, amongst others.
There's also a major issue in terms of brands, individuals as brands as well. So take, for example, a radio television station. They have a breakfast announcer that has a Facebook account. Many people follow them because of position. And then they move on to a different company. They take that followership with them.
Because it's their personal Facebook. It's their personal Facebook. Own it.
But and what happens is that you this is a really big balance for broadcasters, is how do you balance that out? How do you actually make sure that you don't lose that followership that's built up through a particular brand, which happens to be a person, and if that person moves on, then you know how do you manage that? So it's something that it's very mindful to be mindful of.
Yeah, and look, don't get me wrong, I totally agree with where Paul's coming from. I mean, if I would have thought I thought about that as well, but yeah, I when I found this out, that's why I wanted to talk with you guys about it, because I found it really, really interesting that the only things that were really covered under this IP law is things like software patents and physical, and there's a few other entities which have come through. So anyway, a really interesting area, and just be careful if you are creating stuff and you do run businesses, just around your social media stuff, that like Paul said, you do write it into their contracts.
Yeah, good advice. Thanks for looking into that for us, Brad. That's great. Now, iCloud.
Yes.
There's been an interesting article that we picked up online that I thought was interesting. It was titled "The Hidden Cost for the Magic and How to Avoid It," and really all about the fact that iCloud actually does have potentially has some hidden costs with it, right? So initially, you can get your iCloud account for free, but there are limitations on what you'll actually get for free. So there are things, for instance, your 3G data that has a cost to actually access stuff and then,
yep,
you know, pull things out of the cloud or put things up into the cloud. But there's also a limitation on how much storage that you get from Apple. What, are those sort of the main gotchas, Brad? You've had a good bit of investigation into this.
So the key thing with the iCloud stuff, while I do love the product as well, it's a data hog is what they're trying to get across in this article. And one of the things is, let's just say Paul's got his iPhone 4S and he's talking to Siri and he's got a 20 meg file there. He syncs it up to the iCloud. He goes home. So he's used 20 meg there of 3G data. Mm. Gets home, suddenly turns on his iPad. Now his local data connection will download the 20 meg. Turns on his MacBook Air, downloads the 20 meg. Makes a couple of changes. Will send then that up to both those devices and comes down. So you can start to see you've got this compound amount of replication happening across, so you're duplicating the file. And that's
so
what they're talking about.
In both directions.
Correct.
Well, that article which CNET published, one of the bits I was reading was talking about in a common scenario where your data usage might jump to 80 megs a day or 2.5 gigs, in the direction of 2.5 gigs of data a month. Now, most of us in New Zealand if we used that much data, we would get, crazy bills for our mobile or 3G usage, right?
Yeah, then let me put another scenario to you, Mr. Spain. Your wife at home opens up your iMac at home and buys something and puts an app on the store, out of the store. That app, if it's a iPad compatible or your iPhone compatible, will automatically replicate down onto your iPhone and start cluttering up your screen when she's buying it at home.
Right.
Now, you can turn it off, but by default, it's on by default. You've got to tell that not to do it. So if she goes out and buys Angry Birds, for instance, and you don't have that on your phone, it'll sync down onto your MacBook here at home, and it automatically will come across your 3G connection without you knowing about it onto your iPhone. Now, you actually have to switch that replication off so it doesn't do that, because it's doing what iCloud's supposed to do, making sure the content's everywhere. So you can get in a scenario where a friend of mine, he was going, all these damn tiles on this damn iPhone, and what he was doing is his kids were downloading all these free apps and it was replicating down onto his iPhone, and you've got to turn that off. And it's on by default. It's a simple switch, but
I think that's only across iOS devices, so I don't think if you buy something on say your MacBook, which is
it's only iOS apps.
iPad and iPhone, iPod Touch. But if you've got a number of these devices that are all linked together on same accounts and so on,
You've got the App Store now on your MacBook Airs and stuff like that. It's anything from the App Store. Apologies.
Good points there. So yeah, definitely something for people to be cautious of, and bear in mind there is a limit. Is it 5 gigs is the amount that they actually give you free? Which I could have say, without being trying to be overcritical of Apple here, but I think that's a pretty poor it's a pretty poor amount that they give you when we look at what other vendors are kind of starting to give away, you know, free. When we look at SkyDrive from Microsoft, I think it's, you know, 25 gigs and has been for quite some time. I'd say that most people are probably going to hit that limit pretty quickly, right?
I disagree. I think
if you've got an 8 gig, 16, 32, 64 gig device. And you're trying to sync that thing to iCloud, any of those devices that are full up with music and other content potentially hit that. Oh, although doesn't music's excluded, isn't it?
Yeah, music does not count.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just
because if they can trace the music back to their internal database system, then they'll just use that copy as your backup.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're only talking about contact and data, not even apps. Apps aren't included in that kit.
Yeah, it's photos.
It's photos. It's pictures. Yeah, it's pictures. It's videos that you make and
in the storage side of the replication.
Yeah, so it's 5 gig is not too bad considering that, you know, maybe you probably have 4 gig of personal data at the most on a device, unless you're a prolific photo taker.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'd be keen to hear back from listeners if anyone's got some comments on their experiences. Has anyone actually hit that 5 gig limit? Maybe nobody has hit that yet. All right. Well, that's just about us for this episode, guys. One more topic is there, Brad?
Yeah, look, I'm going to go quickly through a couple of quick things. You want to run Android apps on your Windows devices. There's a new app called BlueStack App Player, which allows you to play Android apps on your Windows devices. Also want to give a plug for the Zoom Web TV guys that we featured a few weeks ago. Been watching a few of the episodes. Great website. And I also want to give a plug to the Discourse guys. Discourse is another great New Zealand technical podcast, and we're good friends with them.
They cover all sorts of stuff, don't they?
Yeah, really
good. All sorts of interesting topics, and I think they're doing this week. They're doing something on the election. So lots of respect out to those guys for the good stuff they're doing.
Yeah, they broadcast after us if you listen to us live, or you can get them on iTunes or Zoom. So yes, when I say been chatting with those guys, it's good to have another technology podcast out there as well.
Although they're not strictly technology, so they say. So, but there is a whole lot of techie stuff in there. So, cool. And the Zoom stuff definitely much appreciation to them for their coverage of the NZ Tech Podcast. And they've got some really, as Brad says, they've got some good content on their site. And we're expecting an announcement from Sony any day, I think, on access to all of their content from Sony devices such as the Sony TVs and so on. So we look forward to that becoming official because we would like to try it out and report back on it. Cool. All right. Well, that's us for another week. Thanks, everyone, for listening in to episode 42 of the NZ Tech Podcast. You will find us online, nztechpodcast.com. Our Twitter handle is nztechpodcast. We're on facebook.com/nztechpodcast. And as mentioned earlier on, there's also a group on LinkedIn called NZ Tech, which is just general tech discussions or what have you. We'd encourage you to join up to that one too. All right, that's it. See you guys.
Ciao, everyone. Have a good evening.
Bye.